And that announcement could also reinvigorate a culture war. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports that religious groups, some for, some against gay marriage, see this as a watershed moment.
When Susan Russell heard that the Obama administration now believes the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, she let loose a whoop of joy for theological and personal reasons. She's a liberal Episcopal priest, and she's in a committed gay relationship.
God does not discriminate against same-sex couples, and we don't believe the federal government should either. And this is an important step toward making that goal a reality.
Russell, a minister at All Saints Church in Pasadena, California, says this is the latest victory in a long but increasingly successful campaign.
The momentum seems undeniable.
Six states and the District of Columbia recognize same-sex marriage. Maryland is expected to join them soon. Several courts have ruled in favor of gay marriage, and with the rise of civil unions and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military, Russell says public opinion seems to be heading in her direction.
We're getting past the point where those who claim that the sky would fall, the world would end, and the sanctity of marriage would be ended forever, we can look around and say that isn't happening.
Not so fast, says Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention. Witness the fact that two-thirds of the states have passed laws or constitutional amendments prohibiting same-sex marriage.
Every time the people have had an opportunity to vote on it, they have voted to defend marriage as between a man and a woman. And so they have had victories among the elites in the court system, but they have not had any victory with the people.
Land believes the White House move will galvanize religious conservatives.
The president and the attorney general have reintroduced what has been a wedge issue into the campaign.
And Land notes the last time marriage was a major election issue in 2004, conservatives came out to vote in droves. John Green, a political scientist at the University of Akron, says both sides can claim victories. And he says,
I suspect that we'll see that seesaw battle continue in the short term.
After all, Green says, according to the Pew Forum, more than half of all Americans oppose redefining marriage.
But if one looks in the long run, there is some indication that the battle may gradually shift in favor of same-sex marriage. And that is because the youngest voters are the most supportive of same-sex marriage.
55% of people under 30 approve of it, while only 30% of people their grandparents' age do. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, says he's resigned to what he calls an overwhelming wave in favor of homosexuality. It's become normal, he says, in movies and sitcoms, in academia, in political and judicial circles. So, how will conservative believers respond?
I hope what Christian conservatives do to respond to this is to remember that we know what marriage is and what our accountability is, and that we raise our children to understand what marriage is, and we understand that in doing so, we may be doing this against the larger cultural tide.
One he believes that is becoming harder and harder to resist. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Let's turn to some well-off people trying to avoid the embarrassment of pulling up to the red carpet on this Sunday for the Oscars in a gas-guzzling limo or SUV. NPR's Ben Berkman reports there are options.
Can celebrities have their environmental cake and eat it too? EcoNation co-founder Ben Block thinks so. We've just closed the doors to a hulking black GMC Yukon with three roomy rows of seats and entertainment system and plenty of refreshments, including Fiji water. And the most important feature, this is a hybrid.
A lot of people still don't think these are very environmentally friendly, but they really are. They're quite good on gas mileage, actually better than what we've seen them project.
That's 20 miles per gallon in the city, which could seem eco-friendly only compared to the 15 miles per gallon on the non-hybrid model. EcoNation does business all over the world, but its biggest success has come in the image-obsessed world of entertainment. The company has contracts with most of the major Hollywood studios and will be taking dozens of stars to the Oscars.
We've had a lot of celebrities say, you know what, I've been rolling around in such a big SUV that's not green and feeling bad about it for a while just because I see all these other people doing this. And I don't necessarily know enough about it yet, but you know what? I want to start by doing something.
The most popular vehicle at EcoNation is the classic Lincoln Town Car, fueled by compressed natural gas. For many clients, though, Block says only one car will do.
You'd be surprised the kind of people who will only take a Prius. A lot of big names you know, a lot of the heads of studios. I mean, it's amazing because even the times where we've said, can we put you in something else? They've said, no, that's all I want to ever be in.
And if you do go with the Prius, just be sure to keep your entourage small and don't forget to leave room for the chauffeur. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Academy Awards are this weekend, but we're going to look back now to 1957. One of the Oscar nominees for Best Documentary that year was Lionel Rogerson's On the Bowery. It was set on New York City's Skid Row. In addition to an Oscar nomination, the film won the top documentary prize at the Venice Film Festival. But Rogerson then fell largely into the footnotes of American cinematic history. Now, Rick Carr reports, that's changing.
Imagine this happening today. The director of an indie film about alcoholics on the streets of Lower Manhattan lands an interview on the Today Show. It happened to Lionel Rogerson, who was grilled by host Dave Garraway.
Mr. Rogerson, what made you want to make a movie that must leave people, most people anyhow, depressed when they leave the theater?
Well, Dave, I don't think it's a film that leaves people depressed. Have you seen the film?
No.
On the Bowery is a stylized snapshot of life in New York's gin mills and flop houses. Its main character is a guy named Ray Salyer, who Rogerson found living on the Bowery. In the film, he's new in town. He shows up in a Skid Row bar and buys a bottle of cheap wine for some guys he meets there. When the bottle's empty and there's no more forthcoming, all of his new friends take off but one, the film's other main character, Gorman Hendricks.
I've seen him more in evidence, so naturally he's gonna go.
Anything for a drink, huh?
Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes.
Well, the Bowery boy.
Hendricks and Salyer will do just about anything for a drink, too. They end up selling off some clothes in Salyer's bag. Then they get loaded. The next day, they scrounge for work or panhandle in Midtown. Then they get loaded. And so on. Throughout the film, the men portray themselves. Director Rogerson sketched out scenes, then let the men basically play out their own lives for the camera. Between those sequences, Rogerson cut in shots of real life along Skid Row. Men pick rags, pass bottles, and pass out on sidewalks. But there's a lot more going on in this depiction of the Bowery's alcoholics.
You go beyond seeing their problems and their difficulties to their seeing their humanity. I think that's one of the most important things about the film.
That's Michael Rogerson, the director's son. Lionel Rogerson died 10 years ago. Michael's been leading the drive to revive his father's work. He's made his own career as a painter, and he says the images in his father's films, especially the detailed black and white portraits in On the Bowery, floor him.
Yeah, the human face is something rather extraordinary. I think my father had an extraordinary fascination and feeling for it, which comes through in that film. Every time I see it, I see something I haven't seen before. I think it's a phenomenon which I find actually rather incredible, because you see a film 5, 10 times, and you see something new each time, and I never get tired of it. I think it has to do with the beauty of the cinematography, but also this whole concept of portraiture of these faces, which are ravaged but very human and beautiful at the same time.
Those portraits of the Bowery men were actually inspired by Rembrandt. But Lionel Rogerson didn't just set out to make a beautiful film. In a documentary about On the Bowery, he said he wanted to change the world, so he abandoned the family business.
One day I said, well, I'm going to get out of this textile business, synthetic fiber business. I'm going to make films about what's going on in the world. We just came through the Holocaust, which was insane. Something's wrong. I have to find out with my camera.
His son, Michael Rogerson, says the U.S. wasn't really ready to see what was wrong with society. Sure, the film won an Oscar nomination, raves from critics, and the top documentary prize in Venice. But after that awards ceremony, Michael Rogerson says his father learned just how the U.S. establishment saw the film.
So there was some kind of a big to-do afterwards. You know, a lot of Italian press. The American ambassador was there. And I think my father went to shake her hand or whatever, and she turned her back on him and walked out.
We're talking about the period when McCarthy was still, if he was not there in person, then his spirit was still there.
That's Jonas Mekas, one of Lionel Rogerson's peers on New York's avant-garde film scene in the 50s, not long after Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunts. Mekas is also founder of the city's anthology film archives, which preserved the negative of On the Bowery. He says Lionel Rogerson was a member of a seminal group of New York filmmakers.
They had possibilities and dreams, but nobody wanted to sponsor their films. I mean, Lionel kept writing scripts and nobody wanted to produce his films.
Lionel Rogerson's second film won raves from critics, too. 1959's Come Back Africa is another docudrama set in the townships of South Africa under apartheid. It'll be released to theaters and on DVD, along with On the Bowery, later this year. While the movies live on the Bowery's two main characters didn't do so well. Shortly after the film was completed, Gorman Hendricks drank himself to death. And Ray Salyer, whose good looks and charisma won him an invitation to Hollywood, simply disappeared. For NPR News, I'm Rick Carr in New York.
Our next guest studies the differences between the retirement plans of public and private workers. Benefits for public workers have been one of the issues in the political showdown in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Olivia Mitchell is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and she says people in the private sector have pension envy.
There have been many efforts to try to compare the compensation of private and public sector workers, and typically the results show that public sector workers do get paid more, not only in terms of wages and salaries, but especially in terms of retirement benefits, health care benefits. Now, it's a little bit hard to compare apples and oranges because you have people in the private sector maybe earning higher wages and salaries. On the other hand, the public sector workers have early retirement, job security. It's a more well-cushioned lifestyle.
So what is the biggest issue in the public sector with these defined benefits, given the economy? What's the biggest concern?
Well, in a traditional defined benefit pension, the employer makes a promise that you will get a stream of income when you retire until you die, and your spouse too, if you elect that. In order to meet that promise, the employer, and frequently the employee, makes contributions to that end. The problem is that in many states and many cities, those contributions have not been made over the years. Number two, the contributions that were made got invested heavily in the stock market. And as we know, these haven't been friendly times for stock market investments. And number three, we're all living longer than analyzed or estimated, so that the money's running out, quite frankly.
And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about what that means, but what can or should or dare state and local governments and the federal government do about this?
Well, for example, the city of Philadelphia has underfunded liabilities of about $17,000 per household, that is, in the whole city. New York City is up at $39,000. Chicago is up at $42,000. It's going to take about a quarter or perhaps a third of Philadelphia's annual city budget just to pay retiree benefits.
Which sounds crazy.
It's a huge problem. And the states, it's been estimated, have an underfunding level of about $3 trillion. That's trillion with a T, dollars. It's really a problem across the board.
Is it a problem so far without a good solution?
A number of states have tried to make inroads. Illinois, for example, raised the retirement age for public workers from 60 to 67. New Mexico's raised the number of years required from 25 to 30. But the reality is that we still have this enormous hole. And instead of being 30 years off, it's facing us today.
What does it say generally about the whole notion of retirement? Something that's been held very dear for at least half a century.
It's certainly true that at the turn of the 1900s, retirement was nothing that people aspired to. People essentially worked forever in whatever capacity they could. Then when the Social Security system, the Medicare system, private pensions came into play, retirement became that golden objective that the whole series of generations looked to. As we increasingly live to 90, 100, even 110 years old, it's just very difficult to finance 50 years of not working.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Olivia Mitchell is the Executive Director of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. General Motors is making money again, and a lot of it. After reinventing itself in bankruptcy with a big assist from taxpayers, GM reported annual profits of $4.7 billion today. It's the company's first profitable year since 2004. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, the numbers are so strong, they're prompting speculation that GM's recovery is complete.
It's been a banner year for General Motors. But in this last year, GM and its CEO, Dan Akerson, have made it a point of sounding humble.
We know what went wrong, and I believe we've learned a lot from that.
That's Akerson when the company went public in November. Here he is on this show back in December.
On behalf of the company and all of its employees, I'd like to thank the American public for their assistance.
And this morning.
We know we still have a lot to do, and we plan to continue to build on our progress.
GM's post-bankruptcy balance sheet is impressive. These are the best profits since 1999. But what about the company's culture?
I think they still have more work to do internally.
Rebecca Lindland is an analyst with IHS Automotive. She says GM has done exceedingly well in the last year, but it's not time for a victory lap.
I think that there is still some Detroit-centric thinking. There also is some idea that, you know, the worst is over and look how far we've come.
Despite how far GM has come, its stock took a hit today. Gary Bradshaw, an investment analyst with Hodges Capital Management, says the thing that is hurting GM's stock is far from Detroit.
Fear is that, you know, last week we had Egypt out there, and this week it's Libya, and next week it's, could it be Saudi Arabia?
Bradshaw says fear of uncertainty in the Middle East and higher gas prices has a direct effect on car sales and GM.
I think that person walking in the showroom, when he walks by a pump and it's 329 or 339, they're going to think, well, you know, maybe I ought to hold off and wait a little bit. And so there's a little hesitation right now.
Bradshaw says if nature abhors a vacuum, then the car industry definitely abhors instability, especially in the Middle East. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.